little cartoon there, which I don't remember if this is, I think this is a character called Zippo, if I'm right. It's linked to wherever it came from. But it has a nice little punchline about the only skills I have the patience to learn are those that have no real application in life. And I guarantee you, there's one thing I will guarantee about today's lecture, is that you will appreciate that statement by the end of today's lecture. So I've included this topic in the course because I wanted to add, when I designed this course a year ago or so, sort of updated this course, I wanted to add some topics that were really very contemporary, very state-of-the-art, very current in literature. And there's of course, pros and cons to that. The pros is that you're learning material that's actually under research today and a very hot topic. The con is that you don't have this nice unified view of the concept yet because it's still evolving and people are still trying to figure out what it's all about. So that's one. So today's lecture is going to be a little bit rough because it'll be very abstract. But I hope that by the end of the lecture, the main thing is you'll appreciate what Pachbay's bound means and sort of what this whole area is about. I don't expect you to be able to put this into practice. And to some extent, you won't have to because you have techniques already to do this kind of thing, as we'll see in a little bit. But this is I think it's a very important area that's been emerging, and it has a lot of similarity to what happened in communication theory many years ago when people were developing the first air control codes. And I know these days students tend not to have a lot of background in control theory, in coding theory, so they might not appreciate this, but when I was a student a grad student, I guess I took the course in about 1980, took a coding theory course. Coding theory was a fairly new topic back then. Traditional codes had been around, and a new form of code was emerging, something called a convolutional code. And over the next 15 years or so, every year or so, some new kind of code would emerge, and that code was more efficient than the previous code. And one of the reasons that was happening is because people were motivated by Shannon's theorem on the coding bound that predicted sort of a theoretical limit for what you could achieve in a code. So they were here, they knew the bound was here, and they wanted to basically close that gap. So every year some new code came by. I think we're having a speaker next week here who's been working in that area. And all of that was made possible by the establishment of this bound, so that you had kind of an endpoint, and you knew where you needed to go. So the Pachbay's bound is very much the equivalent of that for pattern recognition, and it's a fairly new concept, but when it was developed, it's been considered, I think, a very significant development, because it's provided a framework which has unified a lot of different types of classifiers in terms of their performance, and it generalized a lot of what support vector machines are. Support vector machines started as a specific technique, but they've been generalized to really create a whole view of how you build learning machines. So what I'm going to try to do today in one lecture is just give you a flavor of what this is all about. If you want to read more, I've got some links to some of the seminal papers there. And if you're looking for a PhD topic that's really impressive, so to speak, I mean, this is work that's being done by some very good, very heavy hitters in the field of statistics and signal, and I would say information theory and signal processing. So it's a really rich area if you want to do some really good fundamental work. But at the same time, it's not going to be easy because it builds on a lot of abstract mathematical concepts. Particularly one we won't talk a lot about today is this Rademacher complexity. This is similar to Kolmogorov complexity, and it's from this whole area of developing or estimating the complexity of a machine. And we'll allude to it a little bit, but we won't go into much detail. So let's review where we've been this semester, because to some extent everything we've done this semester can be viewed from a generalization point of view. We've defined this thing called generalized risk, R, which is the integral of R of alpha of x given x times p of x dx. Can somebody explain to me what this expression means? We've seen this several times this semester. Right. Averaged over all data, right? So this is, in the very most abstract sense, this is a machine. This is evaluating a machine. You build this decision rule or some machine that takes data and produces an answer, and this is telling you, in a sense, how good that answer is across all possible inputs that machine could see. Now, what is the difference between this and probability of error? You might say, well, probability of error is all we ever care about. Am I right or am I wrong? Why do we define things in terms of risk? Right, very good. So different errors have different costs associated with them. Different errors have different data have different probabilities of occurring. So different, you may not want to treat every error equally. We talked a little bit about, for example, in the insurance industry, how you have things like Katrina, once in 100 years or once in 200 year type disasters. And if you develop a strategy based on that, you may very well go bankrupt as an insurance company. On the other hand, what insurance companies typically do is look at very near-term risks on the order of 1, 2, or 3 years. If you develop a strategy like that based on that, and then something like Katrina comes along, you go bankrupt. And that's, in fact, what happened to most insurance companies. They basically went bankrupt when Katrina happened. So they deal in risk. And risk is essentially a fundamental concept in statistical learning theory, because anytime you build a machine from a piece of data, you're essentially betting on the quality of that data. And if you build a machine that's really good at predicting the things from the data that you've seen, you could have a very low probability of error, but you could have a very high risk, because you're really betting that data that you've seen is typical of all data associated with the problem. The Bayes' risk, which we've also talked about, is the best performance that can be achieved for the given data set or problem definition. So Bayes' risk in pattern recognition is very similar to the Shannon coding bound in communication theory, or in compression, or in control, in error control coding. It's a useful theoretical abstraction, but it's difficult to apply in practice. Very hard to build a machine that minimizes Bayes' risk, because Bayes' risk doesn't really tell us how to do that. It just tells us there is some machine out there that could achieve a certain level of performance. We introduced the Chernoff bound, which was an approximate bound on the probability of error. It was originally a bound on the probability the random variable would exceed a given threshold, and it's a little easier to work with in terms of being able to build a classifier that directly minimizes achieves the Chernoff bound. So it's been applied to many problems, including estimating the probability of error from a machine. We also introduced the Bhattacharya bound, which was a looser but computationally simpler bound. Then we segued to a class of learning machines that were built around this notion of relating risk to empirical risk. So we introduced the concept of a support vector machine, but we did that by introducing this very simple equation, which says that the risk, R of theta, is less than or equal to the empirical risk plus some constant F of H, where F of H is this rather complicated-looking expression that is written in terms of margins of the classifier and confidence measures. Now, what was the significance of this risk versus empirical risk equation? Because we're going to build on that concept today. Why not just deal with risk directly? Why did we have to introduce this concept of empirical risk? That woke everyone up. Okay, so this is great, but what's wrong with this equation? So let's think about this in terms of the example we began the class with, sorting salmon versus sea bass. So if I send you off to compute the generalized risk for your problem of sorting salmon versus sea bass, will you be able to do that? No, I just tell you. I hire you. You're, you know, signal processing or us. I call you up and say, hey, I want you to compute the generalized risk on salmon versus sea bass. Here's some money. Go do it. Which is the way it happens in the real world, right? Why can't you compute that directly? Why? Right, we don't know what the underlying true distributions are of various things, so we can't really compute this. We can sort of fantasize about this, we can argue that this exists, but we can't actually compute that. Now, you can compute that if you're using simulated data, and that's often why we like to do simulated experiments, where you have control of the statistics of the underlying process. So, if you remember in your earlier days, you would do things like generate random numbers from a Gaussian random number generator, then you'd estimate the mean, and you'd see how close that mean was to the true mean that was used to generate the random numbers, and you could draw some inference about the accuracy of your ability to estimate the mean from data and all that kind of stuff. And that's why simulated experiments are always a nice way to get started, because you have control of the statistics, the underlying statistics of the process. And if you use a good random number generator, everything's fine. And if you use a bad random number generator, then you also have to worry about how well your random number generator actually fits the underlying model of randomness and all that kind of thing. So why do we introduce empirical risk? What is empirical risk? Right. So if we have risk and probability of error, if you think of those two, this is like an SAT question, right? Risk is the probability of error, like empirical risk is to what? Observed probability of error. What would the observed probability of error would be? I give you a data set and you actually compute the probability of error. Okay, so empirical risk is something that we can actually compute on a data set. It is what we compute on a data set. Assuming we can assign some cost to various types of errors, we can compute that. Now, why are we interested in the relationship between these two? We want to know how close we are, and that gap then becomes an error. We would like to eventually close that gap. And support vector machines, in their most general form, represents an approach where we essentially try to minimize the difference between these two. So this actually the understanding the difference between these two defines a family of potential learning machines. And support vector machines is one attempt at to that where we try to minimize this. Now, this, so if this is, if you accept this equation as written, and then I ask you, well, what's the optimal learning machine? Well, you would say, oh, a support vector machine, because a support vector machine tries to minimize this for a given level of confidence. Now, why is that not the end of the story? And to answer that question, if you have some experience with coding theory or communication, think of that in the context of communication theory. Why can we go further than this? So that's point number one I'd like you to take away today. So let's make sure we understand that. So if we minimize this, if our criterion is to minimize this, the solution is a support vector machine. This is something. This is an abstract concept. We really know what it is, but it exists out there somewhere. This is what we can measure on data. This is an inequality. So, what might we? So what can we do? Is there room for further improvement? And that's really, the answer to that question is really what bounds are all about. So the answer is, you can think about this as a bound in that this is an approximation to this. And the difference between these two is governed by this, but there's also an inequality here, which means we don't really know how tight this bound is. So it could be that this is our actual risk. So this is R. And this is our empirical risk. And the difference between these two is this F of H. But this is an inequality, so this F of H could actually be looser than it needs to be. We don't really know. But we might wonder, so this R plus F of H could actually be something like this. Because this is an inequality, right? So the question is there a tighter bound? And if there is, now you might say, thinking back to that cartoon at the beginning, okay, well, so what if there's a tighter bound? I'm not going to lose sleep over that. But determination of that tighter bound might lead us to a whole new family of learning machines. And that's why we ask questions like, is there a tighter bound? The insight that we get in doing that will hopefully lead us to better learning machines. So the reason I wanted to introduce this concept is because you will see in the literature now learning machines that are derived from the Pack-Bayes bound. And there's a whole area emerging of people doing this. And it's a very new area. And I haven't worked much in that area, so I'm still learning some of this as we go. But it's a result of the fact that we now understand there's different alternatives to this bound. So that insight has generated a term known as probably approximately correct or PAC learning, and it's a funny term. And I don't know the history of the derivation of that particular term, but all it's really referring to fact that we're looking for another form of bound. So as an example, and I give a reference to the notes here that I took this from, a very nice lecture on this topic. Uh, We want to learn the concept of medium-built person from examples. We are given the height and weight of end individuals in the training set. And we want to know which value of end to use if we want to learn this concept well. Our concern is to characterize by what we mean by well or good when evaluating learned concepts. So let's think about that for a moment. We want to learn the concept of medium-built person, and we realize that it's probably pretty easy to talk about tall people and short people, big people and small people, but medium-built is definitely going to be a problem, right? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder and all that. So we know we're in for trouble, and we know that therefore, our ability to make this determination is definitely going to vary as a function of the number of samples that we use. The more samples we use, the more confident we will be in our ability to make this decision. And why is that so? Well, in the limit, we could have a data set that included every human being in the world, and then we could argue that that is the definitive decision because we've exhausted all of our data. So certainly we recognize that we want the probability of error. We want to know essentially how the probability of error varies with the number of samples. But we also want to know how confident we are that we've learned a decision rule from the data. It's not just enough to get a good probability of error with one specific learning machine because, like we've talked about all semester, we could have just been lucky on that data set. We want to really know how general that learning machine is and how well it's done. So we would like the probability of error of the learned concept to be less than or equal to epsilon. For a specific learning algorithm, what is the probability that a concept it learns will have an error that is bound by epsilon? Well, if you remember back in calculus or some of the areas where you've seen this, we always like to set up these things in terms of an epsilon delta type relationship, right? You say, well, if such and such is within epsilon, then such and such will be true within delta. So we would like to set a bound delta on the probability that P of E is greater than or equal to epsilon. Which means that, and that this is a little bit tricky, but when I give you a data set, you build a machine, you get a probability of error, that probability of error is actually a random variable. In the scheme of life, there are many probabilities of error you could have gotten from that experiment. You were just lucky that day and you got a good one. Tomorrow could be another story. So, what we really want to guarantee is that we want to know for what is essentially the probability that the error could have been greater than or equal to epsilon. So, for the probability of error being greater than or equal to epsilon, we want the probability of that event to be less than delta. Yeah, I know. And you were lamenting to me yesterday about statistics, or Wednesday about statistics, right? So this is, but again, today I'm not going to ask you on the final exam to derive a Pack-Bayes machine or something. I just want you to appreciate, you know, as an introduction, some of this material. So, and this isn't too bad. I mean, what we're essentially saying here is you as a graduate student, get up, give your defense, and you say, my machine is better because my probability of error was 1%, and last semester Joe's probability of error was 2%. So as the advisor, I'm thinking, what are the chances that I really believe this student? And advisors, believe me, we do this all the time. There could have been a bug in your code, and you know you could have run the experiment wrong. I mean, so I have to look at this piece of information and say, now what's the probability that I actually believe this student? So it's sort of the same kind of thing. It's what is the probability that this event is true? So it's essentially a confidence measure. We're now in a position to say when a learned concept is good, because if epsilon is very small and delta is very small, then we're in pretty good shape. So this is, I make this statement here, our concern is to characterize what we mean by well or good when evaluating learned concepts. And this is such a characterization. It's not simply how good the learning machine is. It's more about confidence. How confident are we in that particular learning machine? Different degrees of goodness will correspond to different values of epsilon and delta. The smaller epsilon and delta are, the better the learned concept will be. This method of evaluating learning is called probably approximately correct, or PAC learning. And what we're going to do today is to demonstrate or show a PAC bound on PAC learning for Bayesian estimation. Okay, so formal definition of PAC learning. F is going to be, and we're going to get a little bit hung up on notation here because, like I said several times this semester, every one of these areas has their own little bit of notation. So the notation that we're going to see here seems to come out of statistics and come out of people working on this kind of learning theory, statistical learning theory. So F is going to be the target function that we desire to learn. That's our machine. You give me a data point, I pump it into F, I get a decision out. As an engineer, that's what you're most interested in. F is the class of functions from which F can be selected. If your class is, let's say, a neural network, you've got a particular range of Fs that you can achieve with that particular neural network. That's what F is. It's not the specific machine, but it's the class of machines. X is the set of possible feature vectors or measurements. N is the cardinality of X. That just means essentially the size of X. We're very interested in, ultimately, how things get better as a function of N. The better a learning machine, we would like N to be as small as possible. For a given amount of data, we'd like to get the best learning machine possible. D is the probability distribution on X. This distribution is used both when the training set is created and when the test set is created. Oracle of F and D is a function that in a unit of time returns a pair of the form X, F of X, where X is selected from X according to D. So this oracle is essentially truth. If I give you X and I give you a machine, it gives me the truth. What is the actual class assignment of X under the constraint of this particular machine? H is a set of possible hypotheses, and small h is a member of big H, which is the set, and H is the specific hypothesis that has been learned. So you can think about, you have a data point, you have a machine, the machine produces a mapping, and then you have to make a decision about that mapped value. The decision could be you accept the class assignment. The decision could be you reject the class assignment because you look at other measures and you decide you don't have a lot of confidence in that assignment. So we're just adding a layer on top of F, which involves hypothesis testing. A class of functions F, and note now it's the class, not the specific function. So it's really about learning machine rather than a specific instance of that learning machine. A class of functions F is considered probably approximately learnable or PAC learnable if there is a learning algorithm L that for all F in this set F, for all distributions of D on X, I'll come back to that in a moment, for all epsilon and delta in the range 0 to 1 will produce a hypothesis H such that this goodness measure, P of E being greater than epsilon, and the probability of P of E being greater than epsilon is less than delta, such as this is true. Now that's a mouthful, right? But let's think about what that means. So first of all, it's with respect to a class of machines. That's a good thing. That's essentially telling you something about the power, the descriptive power of your machine, not the power of the specific version of that that you've trained on some data. So that's like saying, well, for a neural network of this structure, I could expect this kind of performance on this problem. It doesn't tell you how to actually find a specific neural network. It's giving you a bound. The learning algorithm is just a way of finding the F, the small f, finding an actual machine. And that's ultimately what we're after. So all this theorem's going to really do is tell us that that's achievable, that a certain learning algorithm exists. And of course, it'll tell us that with some probability. So it's, you know, it's all kind of hedging your bets. But the interesting thing is that it argues for the existence of that machine. For all distributions D on X, that's just saying we want this to be true, this property to be true, independent of the actual data distribution. It should work for all distributions of the data. We should not be in a situation where it only works if the data is Gaussian, for example. We want it to work whether the data is Gaussian, uniform, Laplacian, whatever. So this essentially says that a class of functions is learnable if a learning algorithm exists for which this is true. Okay, so you still can't translate this yet into something useful, but it's a nice, it's a theorem or it's an abstraction. F, the class of functions, is efficiently pack learnable if L is polynomial in epsilon, delta, and log n. So that's essentially giving us some notion that of the complexity of the learning machine. And we worry about that because we don't want algorithms which are so computationally intractable we can't ever find solutions. Just they just require too much computation. An example of that might be a brute force search. We could learn all sorts of interesting decision boundaries by doing a brute force search. But that's an n to the n power type problem, or n factorial, or whatever, which is way beyond our computational power. F is considered polynomial pack learnable if n is polynomial in epsilon, delta, and the size of the descriptions of the individuals and of the concept. And this sort of gets into into description length. We talked a little bit about minimum description length. But we won't talk too much about this today, but just, it's a more restrictive version of the previous statement about efficiency. Pack bounds. So McAllister derived a bound on the generalization of a pack learner that is independent of any assumptions about the distribution of the data, and this is referred to as a pack bound. Early bounds have relied on covering number computations, a term they use. What they mean by that, in our case, things like VC dimension and empirical risk. Support vector machines were shown to provide certain levels of accuracy in terms of the VC dimension and empirical risk type thing. While later bounds have been built on this notion of Rademacher complexity. Rademacher complexity measures the richness of a class of real-valued functions with respect to a probability distribution. You can read more about that using the links on the front page. The tightest bounds for practical applications appear to be the pack Bayes bounds. These bounds are especially attractive for margin classifiers such as SVM and classifiers built for Gaussian processes. Now, these are bound. Again, these are bounds. These give you some idea of the asymptotic performance of a machine. This is not an actual machine. So the existence of the Pack Bayes bound sort of doesn't pay the rent, you could say, because that still isn't a machine that actually does something. It's the existence of a performance of that machine. A Pack bound has to hold... has to hold independent of the correctness of the prior knowledge. We want it to be independent of the distributions of the data. It does not have to be independent of prior knowledge, but it should hold independent of the correctness of that prior knowledge. Unfortunately, most standard VC bounds are only vaguely dependent on the prior model they are applied to and therefore lack tightness. This is something we talked about a little bit. We said that support vector machines, the original form of support vector machines is not a Bayesian approach because it's not a statistical machine. It doesn't take into account prior probabilities of the data. Of course, now people have done combinations of Bayesian estimation and support vector machines and such. But as an example, support vector machine or a VC bound does not take into account prior probabilities of the data. The Bayes classifiers, on the other hand, they integrate over the priors, which is often not tractable. So only we've worked a few examples with Bayesian estimation using very simple things like Gaussian distributions, assuming only one unknown like the mean. But it's very, very difficult to apply a Bayesian approach to a general problem and get some kind of closed form solution. So we focus mostly on numerical techniques with Bayes. A Gibbs classifier draws a single sample from the posterior distribution for the class label and uses that as the class assignment. The error rate is at most twice that of the optimal Bayesian classifier. We talked a little bit about particle filters, and you can sort of think of particle filters as being from this class of things that we've talked about, things like Parson windows, which try to actually take samples of the data and develop models based on those actual samples of the data. And those are from a family known as Gibbs classifiers, the same Gibbs from the Gibbs phenomenon with Fourier transforms and such. And the error rate of those classifiers can be shown to be at least, at most, twice that of the optimal Bayesian classifier. And that's one of the reasons why those techniques were initially very popular. So we can begin to put all this together and arrive at something called the Pack Bayesian theorem. And this is sort of the main result that motivates the lecture today. For Gibbs classifier, assume that the prior P of W is independent of the algorithm L. The posterior, however, Q of W may depend on L because L is we're going to take data and develop some machine. So it's reasonable to expect that the posterior distribution we find when we learn will be dependent on the learning algorithm. That's reasonable. But we're going to assume that the priors are independent of L, the learning algorithm, and that's also reasonable. The expected generalization error, which we're going to call gen of Q, and we're going to write that as the expectation of W tilde Q, for whatever reason they use notation. That's the expectation of the generalization of error of W. So this is a theoretical quantity. We can't actually compute this, but it's just terminology. And then we're going to define the expected empirical error, which is now a function of the learning algorithm and the posterior, and that's going to be the expectation of essentially the empirical error that involves L and W. So these are similar to the notions of expected error and empirical error that we talked about with risk. This is abstract because we never know the joint distributions of the data that it takes to compute this. This is something we can compute on an actual data set. And if you do this over a lot of different data sets, and then you take an average of your error rate, for example, you can get an empirical error. And what we're concerned about, going back to what we discussed at the beginning of class, was the relationship between this, which is truth, you could say, and this, which is what we're observing in the lab. We want these two, in general, to be as close as possible. So McAllister showed that, and this is another mouthful, this proof, but it's very, has a lot of interesting subtleties to it. So D is the divergence, the Kullback-Leber distance. This is the way you measure essentially the distance between two probability distributions. And you can think about these terms as random variables that have probability distributions associated with them. And if these two were identical, then the divergence would be zero. So we're going to state the results in terms of the divergence between these two quantities. But the divergence, we're going to compare the divergence under the assumption that these are from Bernoulli distributions, and we're going to compare those to the actual divergence between the two posterior distributions. The divergence between the posterior and the prior. So this D Bernoulli is the divergence between two Bernoulli distributions with probability of success P and Q and P. And so this is essentially, if you tell me what the generalized error is and what the empirical error is, I can plug them into here and I can get a value for the divergence between those two. Now, exactly why this turns out to be involved Bernoulli distributions, I won't go into today, but if you're familiar with Bernoulli distributions, you see these a lot when you deal with probabilities of experiments where you're drawing from discrete distributions, like a binary distribution. So this divergence is greater than or equal to 1 over n times the divergence between P and Q plus the log of n plus 1 over delta, and that the probability of that event, of these two being within this term, is less than or equal to delta. Now, like I said, you know, you're not going to start writing code after class to implement an algorithm based on this. But there's some interesting things here about this. First of all, it casts the problem. This is a nice, interesting concept in terms of learning machines. You have priors, you have posteriors, and we want to think about the divergence, the difference in probability distributions between the prior and the posterior. Now, what would you expect to be the difference? If we just talk at a general sort of probability level, what would you expect to be the difference between a prior distribution and a posterior distribution when that posterior is generated from a learning machine? So let's make that a little more concrete. Suppose I give you a problem, sea bass versus salmon, and I tell you that the prior distribution says there's as many sea bass in the world as there are salmon. And I want you to go and build, remember, your signal processing RS. I want you to go and build a learning machine that predicts sea bass versus salmon. Now, so you come back to me with your learning machine, and I've got this big stack of cash, and I'm going to decide how much of that I'm going to give you based on some information theoretic criterion for performance. What are you going to try to convince me of about your learning machine in terms of the posterior distribution? There's a probability of error associated with the prior distribution, which is essentially no knowledge, just using priors. And if that was a uniform distribution, and it was a two-class problem, the probability of error would be 50%. So you're going to try to convince me that your learning machine is capable of predicting very accurately what one of these two classes. So you don't want that to be, you want that not to be a random distribution. You want it to be a very peak distribution. And you want to show me that if, in fact, a sea bass has occurred, you will predict that with a very good probability. And so you want this to be a very peaked distribution. So this is measuring, essentially, you could say something about the information gain across the learning machine this way. Now, and this is doing something similar. This is saying essentially that the good state is when these two are close to one another. A bad state is when these two are far apart from one another. A bad state is when the statistics of your empirical errors that you're measuring are very far from what the truth is. Because that means you could get a good result, you could get a bad result. The potential for being wrong is very high, and the amount you could be wrong could be very large. So the closer those two distributions are, the better. So this is the sort of saying, the closer these get, but they're related by 1 over n, and they're related by this n plus 1 over delta. So why is this a good situation? We have log n plus 1 over n. Actually, there's a parenthesis missing here. I need to go and check that. I believe the second parenthesis is over here. This 1 over n applies to the whole thing. When you have log of n plus 1 over n, what can you say about that as n becomes large? Does log n grow faster or slower than n? Slower. So log n over n is going to tend to zero as n becomes large. That's a good thing. Why? That's saying that this term goes to zero as you increase the amount of error, and that means there's a greater likelihood that this divergence is greater than that number. So we get an asymptotic behavior that we would expect as a function of n. And then we'd also expect an inverse relationship with delta, because the smaller delta gets, the more probable it's going to be that the learning machine we've arrived at is acceptable. If you think back to the way we stated the constraint in terms of the probability of an error being greater than or equal to epsilon, the smaller delta gets, the more likely that's going to be true. So that's essentially the Pack Bayesian theorem. And again, I recognize it's not clear from this what the value of this is, so we'll spend a couple more slides I think there's a few more slides. We'll talk about this a little bit more next class. But ultimately what we'll show, I mean, we'll just sort of demonstrate this, that to give you some idea of how these errors, we have the actual errors, the empirical errors, and then the errors predicted by the bounds. So we'll talk about this next class.